Welcome to Voices for this Tuesday morning, February 26, 2008. First, you'll hear a recent speech given at the University of Maine in Orono by David Cobb, 2004 presidential candidate for the Green Party. For the discussion that follows that, he is joined by Maine's Pat LaMarche, activist journalist and David's running mate in the 2004 campaign.
It is really an honor to be here, and I want to join Derek in thanking first John and Katie Greenman for your incredible hospitality in welcoming my colleague Shannon Tracy and myself here to Maine. I also want to thank Derek himself of the student government for the work that you did to get us both here, the Peace Studies Program, the Orono Peace Group, the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine. And it's really my pleasure to recognize all these peace and justice groups came together to bring Shannon Tracy and myself here tonight. I also, before I get into to sort of my larger speech, Pat LaMarche wrote a book about her experiences traveling across this country, staying in homeless shelters. It's called Left Out of America. And if you haven't read it, you should. It's only $15. Pat will sign it here tonight. And the fact that, I'll never forget actually when Pat suggested to me that this is what we ought to do with the pennies that we were raising. Rather than go and have rallies and traditional, make brochures or the traditional kind of campaigning, that instead we ought to organize a tour and go to homeless shelters, and that she would actually use that tour to get local Greens to get cosmetics and food and drugs to people who were living in homeless shelters, I knew I had picked the right person to be my running mate. And so I want to urge each and every one of you, if you haven't read this book, please purchase a copy from Pat and read it, because it'll really help you understand why it is that Pat and myself and over 250,000 other people in this country have actually registered and joined the Green Party. Because, folks, to us, the Green Party is not a political party. Now, it is a party. Yes, we run candidates for office. In fact, we elect people to office across this country, which, by the way, I should say, is one of the great untold stories. If you listen to corporate media, you would not know the fact that the Green Party is growing, getting larger, stronger, and better organized with every single election cycle, electing people at the local level in every state in the union. You wouldn't know that. But it's true. You know, but the reason that I'm a Green, that Pat's a Green, that so many other people are Green, is because there is no other place that we would be a member of a political party. Because to us, peace and justice and democracy are not concept abstract ideas. It's what we want to do. It's why young men like Derek Mitchell will organize spaghetti dinners to save a young man's life. You know, it's what we do day in and day out to make this world a better place. And you know what? We've got a lot of work to do. Because today, corporations are not merely exercising power. Corporations are ruling us. As surely as kings once ruled their subjects, as surely as masters once ruled their slaves, corporations are ruling us. And I am not laying it on too thick when I say that, because corporations, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs, are making the fundamental public policy decisions that you and I have to live under. Pop quiz, how many people here are eating genetically modified foods? Raise your hand. Right. See, this is the problem coming to University of Maine, you know, the smart folks here. You know the punchline. The answer is we're all eating genetically modified foods. But here's the really deeper question. Who made that decision? Was it the city council here in Orono? Was it the elected representatives of the state of Maine? Was it even the elected representatives of the United States Congress? No! Who made the decision to put genetically mutated organisms into our public food supply? Corporations. Monsanto Corporation, Archer Daniel Midland Corporation, Pioneer Hybrid Corporation. Folks, the reality is that those corporations made a public policy decision, and they claim and purport that that was a private decision. They take a public policy decision and take it behind a private boardroom and say, not only are you not allowed to meaningfully participate in that decision, you don't even get to know the decision is getting made until after the fact. And the same thing is happening today with our transportation choices, with our healthcare choices, with our educational choices evermore, and whether or not this country goes to war. Today, a very small ruling elite, about 0.5% of the people, unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs, are making those fundamental core choices. And so the question is, what are we going to do about it? What can we do about it? Because I'll admit that there are some days when I get up and I think, there's nothing that can be done about it. My goodness, the forces that are laid against us are so strong, are so powerful. What can one person do? It seems overwhelming. And then I remember U.S. history. Then I remind myself that I come from a proud tradition of ordinary people rolling up their sleeves and challenging entrenched power. And I recognize that everything that is decent and good in this country is a result of ordinary people willing to challenge power and create a new world. Challenge assumptions and be willing to articulate a new way of being. And I realize, you know how systemic change actually happens in this country? It's an amazing phenomenon. The great Mahatma Mohandas K. Gandhi said it very well when he said, actually, if you want real change, it's a simple four-step process. First, know that the elites will utterly and completely ignore you. Check. Second, the elites will laugh, ridicule, and marginalize you. Check. Third, the elites will fight you like hell. Check. Fourth, you will win. I'm so looking forward to that fourth check. I'm hungry for that fourth check. But that's a quick and easy way to say it. Let's take it to the United States of America. And let's ask ourselves, how has it been the case that there's been systemic change in this country? I actually think that four-step process has played itself out in this country with remarkable frequency. But we don't really see it very often because it's not part of our day-to-day conversation, although it should be. And by that I mean, I think that the first thing that happens when people recognize that there needs to be systemic change, not tinkering at the margin changes, but real change, the first thing they do is say, well, you know what? I don't think it has to be like this. You know, this thing called slavery, I don't think that it's right. And maybe I start to talk to my family members and my friends and my neighbors, and you start talking about it. And folks, do not underestimate the profound, powerful experience of simply telling the truth to each other. Right? Talking to one another honestly, from the heart, with compassion, is the most important. It is not a sufficient step, but is a necessary step. So simply talking to each other is the first step. But talking is not enough. The next thing you knew, you realize, hey, it doesn't have to be like this. So people who are talking together begin to organize, right? And then they say, hey, we're organizing. We don't have to accept the dominant system, the dominant structure. So they go to their so-called elected representatives and they say, hey, we'd like to have some change. And you know what? Throughout all of American history, every time ordinary people organized together and went and demanded systemic change from one of the two dominant political parties, the same thing has happened throughout all of history. One of those parties will say, well, you want what? Oh, we'd like to do that. That's such a nice idea, but that's so naive and unrealistic. That simply can't be done. Go away. We have much more important work to do that's actually practical. Go away. Another party will say, well, you all do what? Well, what are you, a socialist or a communist or an anarchist? They got another word now. Terrorist? Go away. You can't even be heard in the process. But folks, don't you realize that both of the establishment political parties, anytime a demand for systemic change comes to them, they ultimately both will say the same thing. Go away! want you to think about this. Let's not only be grateful for, but let's honor the fact that people before us did not go away. They did not quit. They did not give up. They continued to educate, to agitate, and to organize. And ultimately, they came to the conclusion that I've come to, that Pat LaMarsh has come to, and that 250,000 other Americans have come to. And that is, we've got to organize our own political party that will run candidates for office on our principles, on our values, on our issues. And it took alternative political parties, so-called third parties, to champion the abolition of slavery. Women getting the right to vote. The creation of the Social Security Administration. Unemployment insurance. Workers' compensation laws. Pure food and drug laws. The end of child labor. The direct election of the United States Senate. Folks, the entire fabric of what we today would consider the bare damn minimum for a just and compassionate society, that fabric had to be woven together by people who did their work when they were called naive and unrealistic, when they were called dangerous and un-American, and when they were called spoilers. And so today, I assert, I posit, I believe in all of my heart, if we're going to build a social movement that is actually going to make systemic change, it will only happen when those people who are committed to peace, justice, democracy, and environmental protection band together and only vote for candidates who are willing to articulate those values. And I'm going to put a fine point on it. If you want to live, not just talk about, to live in a society that will end war as foreign policy. If you want to live in a society that will guarantee health care as a fundamental human right and not a commodity that will be bought and paid for at a profit. If you want to live in a society that will raise the minimum wage to a true living wage. If you want to live in a society that will dismantle this corporate managed international trade that is actually driving environmental protection and wages to the bottom, enslaving people of color in the global south in order to support an ultimately completely unsustainable lifestyle for people in the global north, and I mean yes, in this country. If you want to see a true transformation of society, folks, you got to have the courage and the conviction that the abolitionists had, that the trade unionists had, that the women's suffrage movement had, that the civil rights movement had. The only way movements ever start moving is when people who think like that start to move like that. And so at the end of the day, I want to acknowledge that there are so many people in this country, in the state of Maine, who are just not ready yet to vote green. Fair enough. Let me appeal to you to register green. Because if we can convince you to register into the Maine Independent Green Party, you can vote for peace and justice every single day. Because you will be standing with how many thousand people now are registered in the Maine Independent Green Party?
35.
Say that number again.
35,000.
35,000 Mainers. That's not bad, folks. Now, at the end of the day, I want to be clear about this. I don't run in I don't involve myself in elections because it's really what I like to do. I mean, I work in elections because I feel like I have to do it. And I really mean that seriously. I mean, Pat may remember that actually in 2004, I didn't want to run for president. I tried to get Medea Benjamin to run for president for the Green Party. I tried to get Cynthia McKinney to run for president of the Green Party. I might have actually talked to you during that. I was actually committed. I said, the Green Party needs a woman to run this time. I mean, the only reason I ended up running was because I couldn't get anybody else to do it. So thank you, Pat, for being willing to run with me at least. But the point that I'm making is that I don't believe that any Green really commits ourselves to elections as the end-all be-all. We understand, though, that there needs to be an electoral arm for our movement. But I want to be clear about this. My litany, my list of all those great accomplishments that electoral parties before us championed, elections alone will not deliver any of those things. We need vibrant social movements. You need to get involved with the Orono Peace Group. You need to get active with the Peace and Justice Center of Easton, Maine. You got to join the Peace Studies program, right? You got to get involved in local efforts that are where you live, work, and play. right? You've got to get engaged and involved as an active citizen in order to build a vibrant social movement. But here's the thing. A vibrant social movement alone is not enough, because a vibrant social movement might change the culture, change the way people think, but we can't solidify any of that into policy unless there are elected officials who are actually tied to those social movements. And likewise, if there is a vibrant Green Party but no social movement behind it, then there's no legs. There's no there. It's just a paper party. And that's the point that I'm making. There really have to be both. And what so much bothers me is that so few people today see the links that to me seem so self-evident. The need for a vibrant social movement and a political party running and connected to those two. And I'll be very candid with you. I don't care whether that political party that's connected to the social movement is called the Green Party, or the New Party, or the Labor Party, or the Progressive Party, or the Democratic Party. I really don't. What I do know is there must be a political party that is actually tied to the principles and values of peace, justice, democracy, and environmental protection. And as difficult as it is to try to create a third party in this country, I personally have come to the conclusion that it will be easier to create an alternative party than it will be to try to take one of the two establishment parties and move them in a different direction. Because here's a little secret, folks. It's a hint for you. You know why they're called the establishment parties? Because they support and promote the interests of the establishment. I mean, it's really true. I mean, so I've actually become convinced as a tactical consideration that we're going to have to go through that process. And the reason is not because there are not wonderful, good women and men within both of those two political parties. The reality is principled conservatives have been lied to and sold out by the leadership and the corporatists who run the Republican Party. But there's a corollary to that. Principled liberals have been lied to and sold out by the leadership of the Democratic Party and the corporatists who control that party. So at the end of the day, what we really have are good people within both of those parties who are operating in a system where the odds are so stacked against them that they really can't break out of it. It's a paradigm, it's a worldview that doesn't allow any kind of real, meaningful dialogue on the systemic change that this country so desperately needs. And frankly, folks, that this country so desperately wants. Because I want to be very clear about this. I am not promoting or supporting Barack Obama for president. But I will tell you this. The amount of energy and enthusiasm that I'm seeing around Obama's campaign tells me that the American people are hungry and deeply thirsty for change. And isn't it interesting that both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and John McCain are claiming to be change agents? I know. This would be funny if they wasn't so damn serious. Huh? The point I'm making is this. That this country is hungry for change, and you can make it a part of change. And whether I've convinced you to vote Green, join the Green Party or not, make a point to demand that change. Write letters to the editor, talk to your neighbors and friends about how that change might come about. Because at the end of the day, it's not that there are not good people within the Democratic and Republican parties, but the structures, both the voting system that forces people to feel like they have to hold their nose and vote for the lesser of two evils, right? The structure, the voting system. And if you're going to do that, at least acknowledge the stench. And the stench is a function of a voting system that doesn't empower you as a voter to fully express your opinion, right? So it's on a voting system where you got to actually rank order your choices. My first choice, my second choice, my third choice would open it up for you, the voter, to actually have more power to fully express yourself. But beyond that, not just a voting system, but a campaign finance system where corporate money has become a cancer that has literally metastasized within the body politic. And I honestly believe that in terms of the amount of on-the-ground organizers, the amount of real people like Derek that actually go out there and do the organizing work day in and day out of the Democratic and the Republican Party, I'd be willing to tell you, Greens could go toe-to-toe. And whenever it comes time to petition to get on the ballot, when it comes time to organize rallies or events, actually, Greens, person to person, are probably about 10 times more effective at doing it than the Democratic Party because and the Republican Party, because those parties write checks and pay people to do the work that we do because we believe in it. So at the end of the day, what we have, I think, to recognize is that we have a system where elections are rigged against us. And if we're going to take elections seriously, let's demand a democratization of elections in the United States. And by that I would mean, first we got to start by counting all the votes. Isn't it a pity that we got to start with that? And by the way, can I just take this opportunity, since we're on WERU, where the truth can be told, non-corporately filtered news, information, and analysis, can we just tell the truth and say, George W. Bush steals elections? Don't you think that ought to be said more often? I mean, don't you think that that needs to be said more often? It's the truth, right? He stole 2000. He was never elected. And in fact, we know that for a fact because when all the votes were actually counted in Florida, the fact of the matter is Al Gore got more votes. Therefore, he won the Electoral College. 2004, our effort for the recount, pretty much for which several people went to jail, we found out that there was never an actual accurate count in Ohio, but that between these so-called black box voting systems that people would try to vote for John Kerry and the votes would flip to George Bush, that you had lines in African-American precincts and college precincts and low-income white precincts that where the lines were 6, 7, 8 hours long, and in the affluent white districts that the lines were 15 and 20 minutes. All decisions made by the Republican Secretary of State on how to allocate voting machines. The fact that there was an intentional, deceitful effort to squash the vote targeting poor people and people of color in Ohio. John Conyers did a report on that called What Went Wrong in Ohio, and it is basically an indictment against the Secretary of State of Ohio and how that campaign went. Fact of the matter is, if we're going to democratize elections, we got to start by counting all the votes. But that's not enough. We got to get corporate money out of the election system, and we need publicly funded elections following what you're doing in Maine so that ordinary people can have a shot at serving in elected representatives. I mean, you know what? One of the most uplifting things that I heard was that in Maine, you got a plumber and a waitress in your state legislature. That just makes my heart feel good. You know, and I'm hoping that the rest of the country can follow your lead and begin to build the momentum of having publicly funded elections. So, I mean, elections are the infrastructure of democracy. It's not enough to just vote, but if we're going to take elections seriously, just as we understand that roads and water and fire protection are the infrastructure of our civil society, elections are the infrastructure of our democracy. And we need publicly funded elections. We need to get the corporations out of the casting of ballots, the counting of ballots, the keeping of the voter rolls. We need instant runoff voting so that people can actually vote for what they want instead of against what they hate. We need to re-enfranchise formerly incarcerated people so that the racist criminal justice system is not focused and targeted upon people of color to ensure that they never get that they're never able to actually participate with political power. We need to abolish the Electoral College so that the people can actually elect the President of the United States. And they should do it with instant runoff voting to guarantee that there's a majority winner. You know, these are simple ideas that will be difficult to do. But folks, it is no more difficult than the abolitionists who had the audacity to challenge slavery. It's no more difficult than Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass, the male allies of first wave feminism, who got together and had the audacious idea that women might actually have civil human rights. Because that was a revolutionary idea at the time. It's no more difficult, our challenge today, than the trade unionists who organized for workers' protection at a time when it was a criminal conspiracy to do so. Working men and women were tarred and feathered, beat, murdered, and imprisoned for trying to organize for better working conditions. The challenge facing us today is no more difficult than that facing Martin Luther King Jr. and the rest of the civil rights activists who dared to believe the promise of the United States of America. So at the end of the day, what I'm saying is we need a vibrant social movement. We're going to make demand for changes. And I'm here to say I'm in it to win it. And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the political party ultimately is, but there has to be a vibrant social movement and there has to be a political expression of that social movement. And at the end of the day, we are going to live in a society that is peaceful and just and democratic and sustainable. Because if we don't, then our children are going to inherit a world that is not worth living in. And to me, that's not acceptable. So I want to thank you all for coming out on this cold May evening. I want to thank again Katie and John and all the rest of you who opened up your homes. And I want to invite you, if what you've heard from me, not the Green Party stuff, but the social movement stuff, the challenge to corporate power stuff, if that makes sense to you, my colleague Shannon Tracy is going to pass around a sign-up sheet. If you'd like to stay connected to the work that we're doing to make real the promise of democracy in the United States of America and find out about what people are doing across this country to challenge corporate power, sign up with us. Be part of this growing movement. And I want to thank you all, and peace.
I don't know if I mentioned it, but it's all about me.
And it is.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about what you did in Humboldt County, because that is a miracle. And it, when people ask you a question, if you would repeat their question so that they
thank you so much. And did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. So Pat has so kindly asked me to tell y'all the story of Humboldt County. So I'll do it very briefly. In Humboldt County, California, we, like you, have experienced corporations coming in and trying to run roughshod over our political process. And in our case, Walmart spent $300,000 in a community of 35,000 trying to change the zoning laws so that they could put a big box store on the last 30 acres of undeveloped land on our bay. We beat them back. But we had to raise about $100,000 and spend untold hours organizing, fighting back the big box. A couple of years later, our district attorney filed a lawsuit against a logging corporation alleging that logging corporation had fraudulently filed timber harvest plans and had lied, and as a result was bringing a criminal lawsuit against them. So, of course, the lumber corporation did what you would do if you got sued by the district attorney alleging a criminal violation. The logging company mounted a recall effort and spent $250,000, $250,000, trying to unelect that district attorney. Folks, that both of those obnoxious efforts were completely and totally legal. Completely and totally legal because corporations are considered persons under our current legal system and as such have First Amendment political free speech rights. And so at Democracy Unlimited, we organized to fight the Walmart battle. We organized to keep our district attorney. But every step of the way, we also wrote letters to the editor and op-eds and got on the radio and constantly said, this is wrong. Yes, we've got to beat it back. But the real tragedy is that we're having to go through this process. Why does this corporation have the right to do that? And so, seeing a teachable moment with an angry, outraged citizenry, we then drafted an ordinance that would say corporations from out of our county cannot make contributions in local elections. And we tied it to a deeper analysis that said, and corporations cannot claim constitutional rights to overturn this law. So we wrote a law and mounted a concrete campaign to make our elections more secure, to keep corporate money out, and built into it a direct challenge to the entire Supreme Court doctrine that a corporation should be considered a person under law. And through the process, we've got together the Sierra Club, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Redwood Peace and Justice Center, organized labor, virtually every peace and justice group. In other words, I love this, the leadership of the Democratic Party and the leadership of the Green Party standing arm in arm at press conferences. In other words, we operationalized a progressive unity that the left so often talks about but so rarely accomplishes. And you know one of the reasons we were able to do that? Because the campaign leaders were women, because the men who were part of that core campaign circle were feminist men, myself included, who were not only able to take leadership from women, but also were able to understand power with dynamics rather than power over dynamics. And so we managed a campaign that was a green-feeling campaign because it was different. Right? And so we changed the culture and the expectation of what elections ought to be like, and we won 55% of the vote. 55% of the vote. A radical campaign that actually challenges 100 years of legal doctrine. And what was so cool about it was, while we did it, we said, this isn't radical, this is just common sense. We have the right to protect our elections, and we have the responsibility to do it. And it was really cool because all of our icons, all of our images, all of our memes, all of our messaging was common sense. We talked about the fact that the Boston Tea Party was a rejection of the unaccountable power of King George, and today our proposition, which was the alphabet letter T, we did a Tea Party of our own. And so we did fun, playful things like that. And we are now one of five communities across the country that have passed local laws that challenge and directly confront the idea that a corporation is a person with constitutional rights.
The movement begs the question, where's the Supreme Court on this?
Right now, the Supreme Court is probably totally against us. Just as the Supreme Court was totally against the abolitionists when the local communities first began to pass local laws making their communities sanctuaries. Because as a lawyer, let me be very clear about this. The amount of justice you will ever get inside of a courtroom, whether it's a local court, a state court, or the United States Supreme Court, will be directly commensurate with the amount of noise that is happening in the streets. Because folks, Brown versus Board of Education was not won by Thurgood Marshall being an eloquent advocate and a brilliant lawyer. Thurgood Marshall did not think of a new legal theory that nobody had thought of before. And those 9 Supreme Court justices did not go to bed racist white men one night and wake up enlightened allies the next. I submit to you that Brown versus Board of Education was won by 50 years of struggle by the Anti-Lynching League and the NAACP and sit-ins and a vibrant social movement that said, we're going to disrupt this society if you don't make amends. And so today, if we're going to really challenge corporatism, we're going to have the courage to disrupt the society that allows legitimate, immoral, and unconstitutional war in Iraq to continue. So what I'd like to do now is stop and show of hands for a question, a comment that would include David Todd Patelarsh, you're full of bunk, and then any further comment if you would so like, but I'd also ask Pat to stay up and so that we could together answer any comments or questions, and if you'd like, just raise your hand and I'll keep a stack. If I've been so loud and obnoxious that everybody is just sitting back, we'll wait a moment. Surely somebody has some comment. There's one. There's two. We'll start with two. Number one.
We had a visit of two very large political figures in Maine this weekend. And I'm just curious what the Green Party thinks about the phenomenon of Clinton versus Obama.
So the question was an acknowledgement first that because Maine actually counted in this caucus season, that there was a lot of excitement in Maine. And over the past couple of days, not only did you have the caucuses, but you had the two, quote, viable candidates from the Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, both coming to Maine. The question is, what does the Green Party think about it? So as a Maine independent Green Party member, I'm going to ask Pat to make the first comment.
Also, I'm really fortunate that I'm a columnist for the Bangor Daily News, and the column also is read in the Journal Tribune in York County. The Journal Tribune is there daily down there. And Common Dreams picks it up 5 out of 6 weeks, which is really fortunate, too. So I did a lot of thinking about this because I was thinking of writing my column on this week about it, but unfortunately Mitt Romney won. So don't miss Wednesday's column before Mitt takes it. But I think they're all fascinating. I think the point that David made about the country's clamoring for change is extremely true. I think it's really interesting. Someone wrote to me and asked who a good Democrat was, and I said, unfortunately, just one of my favorites just stepped down, which was John Edwards. And they said, well, the country's too superficial for such a pretty man. And I said, wait till you get a black boy and a white girl up there. You think the country's superficial, wait till racism and sexism start clicking in. And I think that that's something that is definitely going to be a force. I think the one thing that I feel sorry about, or sorriest about, first of all, when we built a government for Iraq, we didn't give them one like ours. We didn't give them a winner-take-all system. We gave them a parliament with power sharing and having to build a coalition and having to talk to people who disagreed with you to get enough support so that your government could go forward. We didn't give them a system like ours. A system like ours is the one that the really big players want to keep so that they can tell us what to do. And those really big players have now told us that you want change, but you can only get change when people won't change it too much. And Barack Obama, who I think has great courage, I respect anyone who come forward, no matter what their purpose. He voted to make sure that credit card companies could still charge you in excess of 30% on your credit cards. He had an opportunity to vote against usury and vote to help poor people who were being used by these credit card companies, and he didn't take it. You know, I can cite examples. Hillary Clinton not only gave the worst president in the history of time the ability to invade Iraq, she also just recently gave the ability to invade Iran. Like, she didn't learn the first time. So people are being told they can have an acceptable amount of change. But acceptable to whom? And so I'm glad people feel the way they feel. I just wish they had more real belief that they had the option to make that social movement that David talks about and that we've agitated so long for, and that half of us are scraping together an existence to keep fighting, you know.
Thank you, Pat. And I have to say, I think it's worth pointing out that even with this excitement for change, that most people in this country still don't vote. Now, I will submit to you that they're not voting out of apathy. Apathy means they don't care. People are not apathetic. People are cynical. People don't vote because they don't think that voting matters. And when I look at the corporatist agenda that you know the leadership of both political parties, the establishment political parties represent, I can understand that level of cynicism. So at the end of the day, there is a difference between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. At the end of the day, there was a difference between John Kerry and George Bush, right? I've heard me say it many times. And allow me to indulge in my favorite line from 2004, with apologies to some of you who have already heard it over dinner. John Kerry was a corporatist and a militarist. John Kerry voted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. John Kerry opposed single-payer universal health care. John Kerry voted for the No Child Left Behind, which is devastating public education in this country. John Kerry voted for NAFTA. John Kerry supports the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the world, and the entire corporate-managed trade system. By no stretch of the imagination is John Kerry a progressive, and we should not fool ourselves into thinking that he is. That's the truth. But that's not the end of the truth. Because in 2004, there was another truth. And that truth is and was that George W. Bush is a proto-fascist.
that is a genuine threat to the people and the planet, and that I completely understand that a voting system, for some of you who live in states where you feel like the electoral college votes are so close that you may have to hold your nose and not vote for Kerry, but vote against Bush. Some of you will have to do that. And I appreciate that. And I'm not going to denigrate you for doing that. But know this, I'll never do it again. I will never again vote for somebody who does not reflect my principles and values. I understand that other people are different. And so, as it relates to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, there is a hunger for change. But you know what, folks? That hunger for change is the same reason in 2006 that the American people switched Congress from Republican to Democrat. And everybody in this room, everybody listening to WERU, know damn good and well that the reason that that vote happened was because we won out of Iraq. That is the reason that the Democrats took control of Congress, and we're still there, and the Democrats voted to give George W. Bush a surge. So forgive me my cynicism that I don't think that the Democrats are going to do a damn thing different. Number two.
After that, I don't know where I want to go. I just want to thank both of you. I think it's amazing that, you know, after this weekend, we had Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton here. I think it's nice to be able to hear from a third party. My question, because I was wondering if you could comment slightly on that, mechanically in here, food, why do you think that's so bad?
Okay, why do I think genetically modified food is so bad? The question is, would I be willing to comment on genetically modified foods, or GMOs, and why I think they're so bad? Okay, so here's the bottom line. Before we even get to whether they're good or bad, my complaint is over the process by which they got introduced into the U.S. food supply. Because that decision is a public policy decision that should go through a discourse. It should go through a process by which ordinary people get to participate in a meaningful way in whether or not it gets introduced into the food supply. And instead, that decision was made, again, behind private corporate boardroom doors. And it wasn't even announced until after the fact. And today, in this country, it's not even labeled. And in fact, how pathetic is it that the movement that I'm part of, the best demand that we're able to make in this country is, label it! Where in Europe, they say, get it out. We won't buy it. Not only will we not buy it, we won't let you put it in the markets. Now, why do I think it's bad? I think it's bad because it's untested. At the end of the day, what we're talking about doing is tinkering with the very building blocks of life itself. And it has not been, I follow the precautionary principle as a matter of thinking that I think I should not have to prove that genetically modified foods are bad. If somebody wants to introduce something as fundamentally different into our food supply as a genetic mutation, then I think that they have the affirmative burden of proving that it's safe. And that process has not been done. I'm not a scientist, so I don't feel comfortable actually speaking about the science of it all. I do, though, as an ordinary citizen, feel very comfortable in saying, I think I deserve a right to participate in that decision.
It's really interesting to have spent the time I spent with David because he's a lawyer, which is a very good thing. You know, he understands things very differently. I'm a broadcaster. If there's a way for me to make you laugh and pay attention, I figure I can hang on you 30 seconds longer, right, than if I was born in the ears, which I may be proving the point. But as a broadcaster, I had to deal with a lot of things like this in a lighthearted way. I'll give you my first example, which was I have been disdainful about George Bush for a very long time. The current president wasn't all that crazy about his day. But anyway, so, no one could be, people would say to me, I like George Bush because right or wrong, who knows what he wants to do. Well, there would always be the tendency to say, right or wrong, I like him because, I can follow him. Right or wrong, right, maybe follow. Wrong, no, bad idea. You could make a comparison, right or wrong, so did Hitler. But that's not fun. So I couldn't say that. So I said, right or wrong, you can follow no matter what, like, custom. Would you follow? Little bighorn going on for you? So, fast forward a little to the fact that Monsanto got his panties in a bunch about Oakhurst Dairy putting a sign on its milk that said, we don't take milk from cows that use bovine growth hormone. So what does Monsanto do? I could put on my jacket, never marry an axe murderer. If you weren't worried about axe murderers, that probably wouldn't concern you that my jacket said it. You might say, well, is she wearing that crazy thing for? Who cares about axe murderers? What's the problem? Well, Monsanto filed a lawsuit against Little Oakhurst Dairy. They are small, they're big to us, but they're very small in the big scheme. They're much smaller than Hood, which is a small dairy. This is a small, one of the few existing local food supplies we have that was paying top dollar to get milk from farmers who would pledge not to use bovine growth hormone. They slapped a lawsuit on them that Oakhurst just hoping they could blind them into just compliance. So that, because that's inferring someone else does have bovine growth hormone. That's like saying, I'm implying you did marry an axe murderer, so I can't wear my never married to an axe murderer sign, right? So they tried to shut him down. Well, I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a little broadcaster. So I did a show one day about how Oakhurst Dairy had said that they don't use bovine growth hormone, and that Monsanto said, wham, 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 and put it out as though it was a quote. Because they were whining about it. Well, we made these big wham, 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 wham signs, and we carried them to parks. We went to concerts. We signed, tell Monsanto to quit whining. And we got thousands and thousands and thousands of signatures on these big signs that said, quit your whining, get over.
Do you want a picture of Russell Vice President?
In our next segment, Eric Olson interviews Rabbi Amita Jarman of Synagogue Aras Yasharon in Rockland on resolving the conflict in Israel and Palestine and opportunities coming up for Mainers to hear from a representative from the largest national Jewish peace organization in the U.S.
Mainers will have the opportunity Saturday and Sunday, March 1 and 2, to engage with a board member of America's largest Jewish peace group interested in dealing with Israeli-Palestinian issues, in three events open to the public. Dr. Aaron Arhuvia of the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace will make three appearances in Maine on Saturday, March 1 in Portland, 7:30 p.m. at Temple Beth El, 400 Deering Avenue, on Sunday, March 2 at 9:30 a.m. at Adas Yeshurun Synagogue, 50 Willow Street in Rockland, and in Bangor, also on Sunday, March 2, 1 p.m. at Congregation Bethel, 183 French Street in Bangor. This is Eric T. Olson reporting for WERU. We'll repeat that schedule in a few minutes. But today we have with us on the telephone Rabbi Amita Jarman from Adas Yeshurun in Rockland to speak with us about the Jewish Alliance for Justice and Peace events and also give us a view of how the Jewish peace movement is addressing Israeli-Palestinian issues. Welcome to WERU, Rabbi Jarman.
Thanks for having me on the station.
Okay, let's get right into the important stuff here. Can you talk a bit about the situation in Palestine and Israel? We've had so many disturbing news stories the last few months. We've witnessed the blockade of Gaza, Palestinians having kind of a Berlin Wall moment, taking down the part of a barrier between Gaza and Egypt. We've had rockets being fired incessantly from Gaza into neighboring areas of Israel. We've had the Annapolis conference last fall, where there have been at least some movements towards peace. But there's still a lot of tension. And in light of this really quite extreme tension, What's your view on the prospects for peace between Israel and Palestine?
This is an issue I've been interested in and involved in for 30 years, really since I was, in my late teens. And I've been active in, demonstrating for a two-state solution. I lived in Israel, and I went there in 1978, and I lived there for 6 years. And it's hard to stay hopeful given, look what's happening right now in Gaza and in the West Bank. But I think that there's no choice. I mean, we have a presidential candidate now who keeps talking about the importance of hope. And I would agree that we have to be hopeful no matter how bad things look. And the reason that I choose to be hopeful is that there is no choice. Israel and Palestine have to come to a negotiated two-state solution. So people have been saying for decades, look, the final status, what has to happen is there has to be a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza, a Jewish state in Israel. Israel has to withdraw from the West Bank as it withdrew from Gaza. There has to be a Israeli capital and a Palestinian capital in Jerusalem, two capitals, both in Jerusalem. That's where they both want their capitals. The Palestinians have to give up on wanting to return to their homes of, pre-1948. They have to accept the fact there's a Jewish state there. So the Palestinians have to give a lot up, and the Israelis have to give a lot up. And there's no choice. So we have to be hopeful that eventually that's what's going to happen. The unfortunate thing is now, the extremism is just, grows and grows. But despite the rise of Hamas, which is, an Islamic fundamentalist movement, I think polls show that the majority of Palestinians and certainly the majority of Israelis want a negotiated two-state solution. And Brit Tzedek V'Shalom is the largest American Jewish organization right now that supports the two-state solution and works in Washington to, to lobby the U.S., the Congress and the Senate and the Bush administration or whoever is going to be, whatever administration we have to push them, to push Israel and Palestine toward that solution.
So Brit Tzedek V'Shalom is sort of an alternative to the right-wing lobbying organizations like AIPAC. Would that be a fair
yes,
assessment?
AIPAC, which is the older, more well-known, the Israel lobby, its mission is to support, is to generate U.S. support for the actions and policies of the Israeli government, no matter who the Israeli government is. So if there's a right-wing government in Israel, AIPAC supports it. If there's a left-wing government in Israel, AIPAC supports it. So whatever the government is, AIPAC supports it. But Brit Tzedek's mission is to encourage policies that will bring an end to the conflict. So it's not that it's saying that to be pro-Israel means to be pro-peace because it's in Israel's interest, that there should be a peace, and the only way to achieve peace is through a negotiated two-state solution.
Can you talk about some of you were mentioning to me some things that were going on in that area?
Yes.
Can you talk about
Well, yeah. I when we were speaking before the interview, I mentioned that a couple of weeks ago I saw for the third time, it was shown at the Farnsworth in Rockland, this film called Encounter Point, which is a documentary made 2 years ago, based on individuals in the Bereaved Family Circle, which is one of the organizations, Israeli-Palestinian organizations that's working for peace. And it's extremely inspiring. I hope everybody who cares about Israel-Palestine will watch this film, because it's this organization of families, 250 Israeli families, 250 Palestinian families, I think it's growing and growing, who've lost family members in the conflict, who are meeting together just to, you know, get to know each other. And, you know, when Israelis and Palestinians have positive contacts with each other, there's more chance to get over the idea. See, Israelis tend to think that the Arabs hate them and want, you know, to destroy the Jewish state, which, you know, is true of some Palestinians, but it's not true of all of them, and I don't even think it's true of the majority. But that's the feeling that Israelis have, you know, and Palestinians, I guess, feel that, you know, that Israelis don't really want peace, because why do they keep building more settlements? I mean, right now, from the Israeli point of view, they don't even necessarily think that they're building settlements, because there's neighborhoods all around Jerusalem that it just seems like another neighborhood. You know, like we get this idea in the United States right. That, oh, they have these settlements. Well, it's a neighborhood for them. But for the Palestinians, it's like you're taking up more and more of our space. And so right. They don't trust the Israelis, and the Israelis don't trust them. And, you know, I mean, if Israelis believe that the Palestinians would let them exist as, you know, a Jewish state in a limited area, they'd be very happy, but they don't trust the Palestinians, and it's a mutual lack of trust.
It's a mutual lack of trust.
And there are many, many organizations, thank God, working, Palestinian-Israeli organizations working together for peace.
So we have to look forward and look to what's possible rather than what's not happening today.
Exactly.
Okay, well, let me just repeat again those three meetings. The first is on Saturday, March 1st in Portland at 7:30 p.m., Temple Beth-El, 400 Deering Avenue. Sunday, March 2nd, 9:30 a.m., at Your Synagogue, Adas Yeshurun, 50 Willow Street in Rockland. And then at 1 p.m., also on Sunday, in Bangor, at Congregation Beth-El, 183 French Street. Rabbi Amit Ajarman, thank you very much for speaking with us here at WERU.
Thanks, Eric.
This WERU special was produced by Marge May and Eric T. Olson. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for On the Wing coming up next. You're hearing WERU Community Radio, 89.9 FM Blue Hill, and 102.9 Bangor.